ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife crime.
Yes, for 2 weeks after September the 27th, 1958, 16-year-old William Leslie Arnold went around his neighbourhood in Omaha in the United States telling people his parents might be gone for a while as they were interstate to look for their grandfather who had dementia. But he knew the truth, having murdered them, then buried them in their family home in Omaha. So how did the teen, convicted and sentenced to double life sentences, get to Australia, start a new life in Brisbane, where he was known as a loving father to a family he had no idea about his secret past? He had escaped from prison in 1967. There were searches for him. And the case went cold. It had gathered a lot of dust when Jeff Britton, currently the chief of the Office of Law Enforcement Support in California, became intrigued with the mystery and set his mind to cracking it open. Beginning in 2004, when he was still an investigator with the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services, and together with a deputy, Matt Westover, using DNA and modern policing techniques, the case was cracked. Cold case no longer. It's an extraordinary story. Jeff joins us from California to tell us how he did it. Jeff Britton, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Phil. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell me what happened on that Saturday night, September the 27th in 1958.
Well, what we've put together from reports and other sources is that William Arnold had an argument with his mother over the use of the family car that he wanted to take on a date. William Arnold at the time was 16 years old, and his mother denied that request and reportedly treated him poorly, and it may have been an ongoing matter between them. And ultimately, he went and picked up a rifle and ultimately shot his mom. And there's a lot of information that may surround what led up to that, but it was based on that time the basis of the denial of the use of car. But I think there's a lot of other history there that we may not ever know the full details of.
What about the father?
Well, at the time that he shot and killed his mother, his father returned home and ultimately shot his father as well, killing both of his parents.
Extraordinary. He then lived in the house for a week or so with his younger brother, apparently.
He did. And even that day, he took the family car and still went to the drive-in movies and then returned home, spent the night there at his home where his parents still were. And then the next morning, he even went to church.
What did you do with the bodies?
Well, within a couple of days, he ultimately buried them in the backyard of the family home in Omaha.
He's only 16 years old. How did the police, so what did he tell neighbors? He told neighbors they'd just gone away, did he?
He told several people that his parents went looking for a grandfather that may have been quote unquote senile or had dementia of some sort, out of state, and that they would be gone for a while. And basically probably to account for them not being around. He then made arrangements for his younger brother, who at the time of the murder was at a part-time job, and he was also a young teenager. So he made arrangements with a family friend to watch after him, and he went on about his life for several days.
How did the police solve the murder case at the time?
Well, ultimately, not seeing the parents for some time and people started putting pieces together, the actual grandparents contacted the Omaha police and had questions, which ultimately led to them contacting Leslie, as he was known, William Leslie Arnold, often called Leslie, and brought him back to the house from where he was. And he quickly confessed to the murders and then showed the authorities where he had buried the bodies.
So he's sentenced to prison. He gets a life sentence. He goes to the Nebraska State Penitentiary. Almost in a movie plot, he escapes. Tell us how he did that.
In 1967, approximately 8 to 9 years into his sentence, he and another inmate named James Harding escaped over the fence in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is where the Nebraska State Penitentiary is located. We've learned that he had help from a former parolee that had paroled earlier that year. that supplied them with materials and possibly masks and whatnot to account for inmate count at the facility. But on July 14th, with a message used in a classified ad in the Lincoln Journal Star, they climbed over the fence and made their way out of the prison.
So he was on the run, and then pretty much he stayed on the run until he died. Let's trace his steps. What did he do after he escaped? Where did he go?
So that evening, July 14th, into the next morning, July 15th, 1967, they made it to Omaha, presumably with the help of the parolee. He then made contact with a childhood friend from the same neighborhood he grew up in that was just a few years older, and contacted him and said he needed help, and that he, in fact, escaped from prison. His friend, whose name is James Child, who shared this part of the information before, was actually on a date, and he went and picked up the two escaped inmates nearby and then supplied them with food and some money that he had on him, and then ultimately took them to the bus station in Omaha, where they got on a bus to Chicago.
And then they split ways. And so, incredibly, 4 months later, he marries a mother of four in Chicago and begins working as a salesman.
Yes, he did. So within about, I think that it's 134 days, because that number stood out to us when we learned that he met a woman at a part-time job, or a job that he had in Chicago at a restaurant. And she had four kids already, but she was single and she started dating him.
He then divorces her and goes to Los Angeles in the late 70s, where he remarries and has a son and daughter in the early 90s. However, something must have happened then, because he suddenly cuts contact with the previous stepchildren, and he has some surgery, doesn't he? And he disappears to New Zealand. Do you think he had a tip off, or do you think he was worried about getting caught, or what?
I think that ultimately, from the moment, you know, he's serving a life sentence, he successfully escapes the prison. I think he may have been spooked the whole time he was on the run to some degree. But in this instance, I think it's very likely that something got his attention or frightened him, that he needed to move on. And it's my understanding he moved quite a bit over the years, possibly running from one thing or another to avoid being detected or captured.
Mm. He apparently had some surgery to remove a distinctive mole as well, didn't he?
Well, that's what I've been told, that he had did have a distinctive mole on his left side of his face above his lip, mm-hmm. A common mole, and ultimately that he did have it removed, because in many wanted posters of that era, the mole was mentioned, and so it looks like he may have cut that off.
Mm. It's an extraordinary story, actually, because you think, surely they would have caught him by now. But the FBI and other US law enforcement agencies did review the case from time to time. But astonishingly, though, he gets to New Zealand, but he would have needed a passport to do that. How on earth would he have got a passport?
Well, going back to the time that he escaped and was in Chicago, he ended up in some form or another, and probably much easier in that time period than it would be today, was able to put together a fake birth certificate under an alias, that he committed to that alias in its entirety, and was able to successfully get a driver's license and live under that name, and ultimately use that same name for a passport.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, isn't it? Because maybe you didn't need the same kind of birth certificate that you would need these days. I guess maybe there weren't the same checks either, do you think?
Well, I think that technology advancements and security protocols for government documents and identification has just changed dramatically over the years. And so it would be very difficult to do it in the same way today.
Yeah. Anyway, he goes to New Zealand. And then, of course, he comes to Australia in 1997. Now, he dies in Australia in 2010. He's 67. And he's never caught, and his secret is never revealed to anyone, including his new family. How did you get involved with this? And tell us about your collaboration with U.S. Marshal Matt Westover.
Oh, of course. So I started on this case when I was an investigator with the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services in 2004. It was merely a cold case that hadn't been touched in several years. And in fact, he escaped from prison 5 years before I was even born. So he had what I would say is quite a head start of anyone looking for him. But it didn't have the same attention that it did until later years. So in 2004, I began looking into it. And in conjunction with my other duties, began running down possible leads and interviewing people that he had contact with back in the day. And I was able to interview several people from his life and get information. And that's how I learned more about the escape. And ultimately, we were able to locate the former parolee that helped him with the escape. And I worked on that case till about 2013, when I actually left the Department of Corrections and returned to California. And during that time, I still stayed attached in the sense of I didn't know who was going to pick up the case after I left because it was such a cold case. And it was not at the time a primary inquiry. It was something we just worked on. And so I continued to look into it even after I left on my own, thinking about it. What would I do if, and what would I do? What resources would I have if I was in his shoes? And it just stayed with me and became pretty much a case that was a big part of my career. In 2019, 2020, I'm well into my new position, and I was starting to track the use of DNA technology advancements. So, but I had collected DNA during my case in the late 2000, maybe 2009. And I did get DNA sample from his brother, and we used it to put it into various systems to see maybe William Arnold was an unidentified person, but we didn't have any success. But also the technology of DNA in those years was not even close to what it is today.
Yeah.
As I continued to monitor other cases in California, such as the Golden State Killer, I just felt that more could be done. And I reached back out to the U.S. Marshal Service to get their help and guidance.
Sure. I'm talking with Jeff Britton, his chief of the Office of Law Enforcement Support in California, about this extraordinary cold case. So apparently his son here in Australia tried to find out what had happened, or wanted to learn more, and this is how you made a DNA match, was it?
That's correct. U.S. Marshal Matt Westover, and I, when he reached out to me, I told him my work on the case, the research I'd done, and what I've done since to bring him up to speed into 2020. And we began talking regularly. He dove right into the case. He's an excellent investigator. And then he went and got a new sample of DNA from William Arnold's little brother, who's now in his 70s, and was able to make a match, ultimately, that we learned was with the fugitive's son.
Hmm. Wow. What was the reaction of the Australian family?
Well, I've spoken to the son primarily, but I've spoken to all the family at one point or another in the last few months. Obviously, they're shocked, and it's a part of Dad's life that they did not know about, and I don't get any impression that they had an idea of what I would call his first life.
Yeah. It must be quite hard for them to process, really, that here is their father who is guilty of this most appalling crime.
No, it's got to be very difficult, and I think very few people can ever relate to what they might be going through and how they process this and what they learn, because their image and experience with their father is not what anyone else has ever gone through, more likely. Hmm. And it's important to remember that this is just not who they knew compared to who we knew, the person's name.
No, I mean, he was only, you think about that 16-year-old William now, teenage rage about not being able to get what he wants at home, access to a gun, and what he became. I mean, it said that when he was in jail, he was a model prisoner. Is that right?
No, that's correct. And reports that I've read is that he was attentive and responsible and was the a model inmate when he was doing his time, and was polite and responsible to others during his time at the Nebraska State Penitentiary. But going back to the incident itself, there is some information that he may have had struggles with relationship with his mother and parents in many ways. And I don't know if this was this obviously was the icing on the cake for him on what was going through, but it did lead to this. And I think it was longstanding, but still spur of the moment.
Yeah. You do wonder, don't you, Jeff, about what must have gone on for him lying in his bed at night, you know, when there's no one else. I mean, what is going through your head thinking? What's he thinking?
I cannot even begin to imagine that act and what he was processing at the time, what he had gone through. I've read reports that where it was very surreal for him when it happened, not quite clear on what he had done. I think he was trying to, in essence, defend himself from maybe condescending or struggles with his mother and how she treated him. There was one report that she was laughing at him and mocking him.
Yeah.
And maybe that happened for several years, and this was just the event that pushed him over in that moment. Mm. But I would like to say that, you know, fortunately, from what I've learned, it appears to me that he became the parent or parents he didn't have and treated his kids very well.
Yeah.
Good father.
Extraordinary story. And you've told it well. Thank you, Jeff. It's been terrific to talk. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff Britton is Chief of the Office of Law Enforcement Support in California. He's not the only one, isn't it? There are people with double lives like this. You wonder what is going on inside for them. Anyway, extraordinary story.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.